This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of the longest-running
weekly
episodic
comic book podcast
in all of Place to Be Nation.
Yep, that's us.
I am Greg Phillips. With
just
me,
just getting it in under the deadline.
Is Nick Duke
another streak? Another rained in edition, phoned in edition, just to keep the streak alive.
Just to keep the streak alive, yes. And this week it was Mr. Duke that kept pushing us back.
That's not true.
That is true.
That's not true. Our recording was delayed twice. Who delayed the first time?
You. We were going to do it Tuesday.
We were going to do Wednesday, and you said, "Oh, I got a work thing." You said that.
We were going to do it Tuesday, and you said, "Hey, can we do it Wednesday?"
No, we never determined for sure that we were going to do it Tuesday. I said, "I would prefer to do it Wednesday." And then Wednesday comes,
that's what you said.
You call me and say, "Oh, I got a work thing. I can't do it."
I got a work thing. I couldn't do it.
Don't lay it on me. I'm willing
and
to
then
accept
Thursday,
my, I'm willing
you said,
to accept my share of the
I
blame.
I feel like crap. I can't
no,
do
but
it.
No, you didn't even ask me what I said. I asked if we could do it Thursday because I was still at work.
Then Thursday.
See,
what did
now
you say?
See, here's the thing. Unlike you, I am willing to accept my share of the responsibility. You are here trying to lay it all at my feet, which is inaccurate. But we should expect nothing more of you.
We could have just done it on Tuesday.
Of the liberal, of the lying liberal
normally
media,
do.
That's all
you
do
you
is lie
whine
and
complain because you actually had to work
at
for
other
a change.
At other people's
and
feet,
here we
just
are,
just like the liberal media. That's fine.
Here we are. You had to work for a change, and now you're exhausted and tired because you have to join the working world of a government employee like me.
You can take the idiot out of the media, but you can't take the media out of the idiot or something like that.
Spent a lot of time with your family over the holidays.
Yes, too much damn time.
Same here. But nonetheless, we are here, and we're here to talk about Arrow Month. That's right. We spent 2 weeks stranded on a deserted family island, and in that time we realized that when we came back to society, we'd have to become someone else. We'd have to become something else. So we became last-minute podcasters talking about our comic book show, Arrow. Now, Arrow has been one of our stories since it first came on the air, 2012, and we are here today to take a look back, go back in the Wayback Machine, Nick, to October of 2012. I believe it was October. I could just look this up easily right now. But why do that when you can just make dates up arbitrarily and assume that they're correct? Let's go back to 2012 and the creation of Arrow. We are going to take a look here and off the page at the pilot episode of the CW's Arrow, the brainchild of Berlanti, Guggenheim, Kreisberg, and Company. And we're going to discuss how this show has evolved over the years, how it's changed, things that worked from the get-go in this episode, and things that didn't work that had to be tweaked as the years and months would roll on. So let's take you back. Let's take you back to October 10th, 2012, folks. We had been hearing about this show for some time. We had seen still images. We had seen teasers of it. That the CW was getting ready to debut a new show about the Green Arrow, a character that both Nick and I had some familiarity with from the comics. Nick, what are your memories of hearing about this show, and what were your expectations going in?
So yeah, I had started to get into Green Arrow comics around this time a little bit, thanks to I had finally read the Kevin Smith run, which I first encountered in college, the first volume of Quiver, and then I went back and read Sounds of Violence after that, and had started to seek out other Green Arrow comics, most notably the Mike Grell run and some other rare appearances. But I had just started to kind of – I was dabbling. I was not, you know, a full-on hardcore fan just yet. And then when the show happened, I remember pretty much after those first couple episodes, that's when I dove in hardcore into the Grell stuff. And since then, Green Arrow has, as you know, become one of my favorite comics or favorite characters in DC. So I remember when this was announced, I think I was a little bit more skeptical than you were because it was going to be on the CW. And I was one of those people who I had not seen a ton of Smallville. But what I had seen, I did not care for very much, and I was worried it was going to be more soap opera than superhero show, which some people would say it has wound up being, but I suppose being there from the ground floor has made me more open to that than trying to come out on something like Smallville halfway through the run or on random episodes.
Yes, I do recall this quite well. You were skeptical. I was excited because I was a Smallville fan. I watched for the most part with some ebbs and flows here and there. I watched most of that series from beginning to end on WB and then the CW. So I was pretty excited anyway, but I was also a fan of the Green Arrow. Never was my favorite character, but I had read plenty of books with him in it over the years. I had read the entire Kevin Smith run, Quiver, and Sounds of Violence. And I had also read a little bit of the Judd Winnick run. I had read just a little bit of some of the Chuck Dixon run back in the 90s. And I'd certainly encountered Green Arrow in crossovers and cartoons, Justice League Unlimited. I was a big fan of that take on the Green Arrow. And I think going in, one of the things that stood out to us, Nick, was it was a different side of Green Arrow than we were used to. We were maybe... When you hear about a Green Arrow series, you might expect it to be more along the lines of what we got on Justice League Unlimited, that sort of swashbuckling, wisecracking, lefty Green Arrow made famous by Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams, who I declined to mention earlier. I'd read the Hard Traveling Heroes stories, mm-hmm. some of those years before this as well. So I think maybe you would expect that. But as soon as the first teasers came out, it became clear that this was going to be sort of a Christopher Nolan-inspired take on Green Arrow, fair to say?
Yes, it was definitely going to be Arrow done through the lens of Batman Begins, which once we kind of realized that, I became more excited because, as everyone knows at this point, the Nolan Batman is something I've always loved. So this is this was a good turn for me. And so we kind of were entering the first episode. I think we were both excited, but I was still trying to maintain at least some level of skepticism going in.
Yes, which is always healthy to do with comic book media, honestly, so why not? With all that being said, I am actually pulling it up on my Netflix account. You can watch the entirety of Arrow on Netflix through the current season. If you are interested in following along with us, we're not going to probably watch the whole episode, but we are pulling it up right now. We've rewatched it for this, and we're going to put it up just to sort of remind me of a few things that might pop up from time to time. But if you do, I'm going to count you down to hit the play button, and I'm going to do it in 3, 2, 1, play. And there's the wonderful CW logo. So right out of the gates, we start off on the island, which we would later learn is called Leon U, as a hooded figure that we know to be Oliver Queen is running through the jungle. We don't know what towards, but he's running through this jungle on this island, climbs a hill, and notices a ship in the distance coming nearby. And he's going to do a little bit of parkour here, which was a staple of the first season of the show, was some of the parkour stunts that Stephen Amell as Oliver Queen would do. And then Oliver is going to fire an arrow, a flaming arrow, across the way and light a beacon for the ship to rescue him. Nick, what were your thoughts on the sort of right out of the gates starting with a silent intro like this of Oliver Queen on this deserted island, pretty much taking us to the beginning of his story?
It was definitely a solid opening because it leads you to ask questions of how did he get here? What has he experienced? it was a great way to start it. And in the opening shots, you got that Deathstroke tease. So it was a little something for everyone. You know, hardcore comics fans got the Deathstroke tease, and regular CW viewers just got the setup for this mystery that was going to wind up being a foundational part of the first 5 years of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. And then as he gets rescued, I agree that that Deathstroke tease was so cool at the time. I remember that was one of the things that got us most excited about this show. It was like, what a cool tease to the comics of what might be to come, not knowing what we would get when they would go to Deathstroke, of course. We get the cool title sequence here. One of the things that happens at the end of this scene, though, the first scene, which would be, I think you and I would both go on to agree that this was something that didn't work on the show, was the inner monologue.
Yes.
That comes over top of it. Because if anybody that's watched the show, you know the intro to the show features Oliver Queen explaining that, you know, where he, what his origin is, who he is, where he comes from. I would equate that, and that's fine, I would equate that to the opening of any comic book where you read, my name is Barry Allen, I'm the fastest man alive. Or you read, his parents were killed at an early age, and now he punishes criminals who are a cowardly and superstitious lot. Something like that. That's fine. This pilot episode goes a different route where he's sort of narrating the episode as it goes. And I haven't gone through and rewatched the entire second episode yet, but I do remember they dropped that pretty quickly on the show, Nick.
The interior monologues, they were pretty quick to drop those. I remember they probably lasted about a month, maybe four episodes, but by that point, you know, they dropped them. And it's really remarkable because the way this show is shot, they shoot them kind of in batches. So it wasn't like they were shooting the fifth episode at right after the first one aired. It's almost like they realized themselves in the, whether it was in the writer's room or in post-production or whatever it was, that it just wasn't working and it was better left dropped. Mm-hmm. So this pilot was a great way of experiencing some things that worked from the beginning and some things that didn't. And the inner monologues are one of the things that didn't, but to their credit, you know, they were not going to just lay around with that mistake. They were willing to put it to bed relatively quickly.
Yeah, and we should probably get into why it didn't work for us, which to me, inner monologues are something that I've grown accustomed to in comics, and I feel like they're almost, I think they accentuate and they help a lot of comic books, but some things don't work when translating from comics to screen, and I think that to this point, I can't really think of many times when the interior monologue has worked in transition. Perhaps Watchmen with Rorschach.
Watchmen would be one, yeah.
But other than that, I can't think of another situation where that has worked. Like I think it's because it's such a visual medium that the audience kind of, if the actors are good, the audience should be able to figure out what's going through their heads. And I think audiences also like to be surprised, and audiences like TV audiences like to be able to find out things in action rather than being told about things. So a lot of the background that Oliver gives in this episode about Leon Yu, that's all great stuff, but I think it's stuff that as an audience it might have had more impact had we just been able to learn it through dialogue, if that makes sense.
Right, and I mean, in a lot of live-action media in general, that's the case, where when you have interior monologue, it almost takes away from the actors being able to convey emotion silently and through their body language and facial expressions. You know, when you have those interior monologues, they're blatantly telling you what they're thinking at any given moment, which is reductive in a sense. So I'm not saying it can't ever be done, but I'm with you. It's kind of hard to do. Sin City would be another example of good interior monologue, but that's... Both cases that we just referenced were ones that were taken in an effort to almost literally recreate a comic book on screen, not doing a piece of comic book inspired media.
Right. And so out of the gate, the one thing that I will say they got right out of the gate was the casting on this show was really good. Let's start at the top with Stephen Amell as Oliver Queen, / the Hood in season one. Nailed it from pretty much the get-go, but one of the things, you know, I remember at the time we were watching this live, I think both of us thought that he kind of was finding himself in those first episodes, and that by about midway through is when he really became Oliver Queen for us. But rewatching this back, I gotta say, Nick, he kind of nails it from the get-go of this take of Oliver Queen. Like, he's such a, especially knowing what we know now through retcons and later seasons, Oliver is so hardened by this point that he's believable as this guy that is putting on this air of this, you know, carefree playboy that made all these mistakes, but deep down he's this really angry, vengeful guy that's out to hurt people that he perceives as being bad. So I think Amell was really good, actually, pretty much from Jump Street.
Yeah, he was really good from the beginning. Yeah, I was watching him. And one thing that struck me was, like, when Danielle was watching this with me, and when he first popped up all clean shaven in the hospital or whatever, mm-hmm. I was like, my God, he looks so young.
He does. Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. Yeah.
We really have seen him grow up. I mean, yes, he was an adult. I'm not saying that. But, like, we've spent 8 years with him in almost the prime of his life, really. And he, not that he looks bad today. God, I'll never look as good as Stephen Amell does, even when Stephen Amell is, like, 70. But you can definitely see the age that he has taken on mm-hmm. in these 8 years of doing his own stunts and devoting so much time and effort and love to the show. So, but you talk about, I don't know how you want to, if you want to do this chronologically or whatever, but if we want to talk about characters who were pretty much fully realized from the yeah. jump, Oliver, and then the big number two for me, Diggle, is right there
yep.
as the Diggle we would know and love from the very first appearance, really.
Yes, David Ramsey's John Diggle is sensational right from the beginning, because he gets assigned to be Oliver's bodyguard. And I remember when watching this pilot episode the first time, I thought he was just going to be a throwaway character. I don't know if you right. had the same feeling, but there is no John Diggle in the comics, or there was at that time no John Diggle in the comics. And so my thought was, this is just going to be a throwaway character that Oliver, you know, it gets away from instantly. And then I thought we'd never see him again in the episode. And then he shows up when Oliver least expects it, because John Diggle doesn't say no. He doesn't quit. He doesn't give up. And from that moment, there's this little smile exchange between them. And from that moment, you get the impression there's some sort of bond being formed. Even when later in the episode, Oliver incapacitates him so that he can go and do his Arrow stuff. From the start of his appearance here, David Ramsey inhabits this character with so much passion and heart and likability. Like, from the moment you meet him, Diggle is likable, and you feel bad for him when Oliver, you know, treats him badly. And so, yeah, I agree with you on that. And then how about another one that I thought stood out from the beginning of this episode, the first time he appeared, and honestly, in many ways, stole this episode for me. Colin Donnell is Tommy Merlin.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yep. I've never seen an episode of the show, but it makes me hate whatever Chicago show he's on even more now, because jokes aside, in jokes from this podcast aside about my constant prediction of him being brought back, like that opportunity is kind of past, you know. And it really sucks, because there was mm-hmm. so much more to do with this character.
Agreed.
And I'm sad we never got an opportunity to see him do more.
I agree. And he's a source in this episode of a lot of the comic relief, because it's a very heavy episode. A lot of violence, a lot of emotion, a lot of darkness. But then Tommy Merlin is there to throw in jokes about you know, all of the stuff that Oliver's missed while he's gone. At one point, they're at the club, and one of my favorite lines of the episode, they're at the club, and Tommy's looking at these two girls, and he's like, come on, you can, that one in, the one in the middle, or what's her name, is really into you. And he goes, which one is she? And he goes, she's the one that looks like the chick from Twilight. And he goes, what's Twilight? And then he goes, you are so better off not knowing. And so, I mean, I remember that was my favorite line the first time. And then there's the line about the Kardashians, the line about, I mean, there's just so much good stuff here from Tommy. He's a guy that clearly cares about his friend. However, Tommy's also in a kind of on again, off again relationship with Oliver's ex-girlfriend, which complicates things. Tommy also, we don't know that in this episode, but Tommy has a dad who is pretty influential in things. I had forgotten how quickly their camaraderie took off and how quickly Tommy Merlin became a character I really attached to. Willa Holland is here as Thea Queen in the very first episode, and she and Amell have great chemistry, this brother-sister bond that they have. And you find out early on in this episode that Thea has kind of suffered a lot as a result of what happened to her brother and to her father. Katie Cassidy's here as Laura Lance. And I got to say, Nick, not as bad as I remembered her being. I think that a lot of my...
Oh, see, I disagree.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it.
Maybe not so much her fault, but the way this character is written is just kind of...
Yeah, generic.
Like, I get that there has to be some conflict there, but this is a show where the protagonist is Oliver Queen. And so you're setting up this character who we're both supposed to care about and empathize with, and yet just watch her tell Oliver she wishes he was dead. Like, this is... And I get it, it's story-wise, but also, and some of the things, you know, some of the lines they use to get across, like how noble she's supposed to be are very forced, you know, especially Tommy's line near the end about always trying to save the world or something like that. Yeah. It's just...
Well, you know, it feels to me, if we're doing the Batman Begins comparison, it really feels like she is the Rachel Dawes character.
Yes.
Because that scene that you're referring
to... Who is arguably the weakest link in Batman Begins.
I agree. That line that she gives where you're talking about where she tells him to go to hell reminds me, every time I watch it, and I noticed it the other night, it reminds me of the scene in Batman Begins
where she slaps him in the car.
And she says, your parents would be ashamed of you.
And he should have put her in a triangle choke.
Yeah, exactly. Bitch, you take on the Falcones. I'm leaving town.
Yeah,
bye. But no, yeah, I can see where you're coming from. I think that what got to me was, like, I remember her character going, just becoming completely unbearable during the alcoholic arc. And so at this point, she's just kind of generic to me more than anything. I agree that not a very creative character. Thea is actually much more interesting because Thea seems to be a three-dimensional character rather than a one-dimensional character. In that she loves her brother and she's nice, but she's also got a rebellious streak and she's also clearly emotionally damaged. So Susanna Thompson as more.
Perhaps she'll go on a journey of self discovery.
No, Nick, I don't think that'll ever happen. I don't think they've got enough real estate to explore that on the show.
No.
Susanna Thompson as Moira Queen, excellent.
Yep.
Right away.
Yep. Although I wonder how much of that is helped by our retroactive knowledge, like of, because we all hated Moira Queen really throughout the entirety of the first season. And
well,
I wonder how much of this viewing of it is us applying us knowing where she would wind up to this first episode.
The reasons that we disliked Moira Queen in the first season had nothing to do with Susanna Thompson's performance. It had to do with the fact that she was just a manipulative bitch, you know,
right.
She was a heel and she was getting heat. So that was the right kind of heat. But I think,
we're sleeping on one big one though. Arguably by my estimation, if you were ranking performances in this episode, you probably have to put Paul Blackthorne up there.
Oh,
like,
my God. Yes. As Quentin Lance.
Right there with Stephen Amell, if not perhaps slightly ahead.
Above. Yeah. Paul Blackthorne as Quentin Lance is amazing in this episode. Even that first scene when he's sitting there. And he's interviewing Oliver and Tommy about why they got attacked. And at that time, remember, you don't know who he is as an audience member.
Yeah, they don't tell you who he is until after the fact. Yeah.
Yep. And you're like, why is this guy being such a dick? Like, and then you find out why he's being such a dick. That this is the guy that cheated on his daughter with his other daughter, causing said other daughter to die in a shipwreck. And
man, aren't we glad that, by the way, aren't we glad that Katie Lotz got that?
Oh my God. I was going to mention that, Nick. Things that didn't work. This original Sarah Lance.
Yes.
Thank God for that recast. Because the Sarah Lance in this episode is not a good actress, first of all, and has none of the likability of Katie Lotz's performance. Like, this is a performance that is just, it's just dead. It's got no life to it at all.
But anyway, Paul Blackthorne.
Paul Blackthorne. He's sensational. His emotion, especially later in the episode at the club, the scene at the club of when he confronts Oliver, so good. Probably the best scene in the episode, quite honestly. Really, really good shit. But yeah, Moira Queen, the reason that she stood out to me this episode is most of the episode, I like her. I'm like, man, you know, she's trying to do her best for Oliver. And then at the end, that twist, when we find, I remember that was the hook for the episode, for the show for me, was that last twist at the end, when it turns out that Moira had her own son attacked to try to figure out what secrets he knew. It's like, holy crap, did she kill her own husband? What is her deal? I thought that was just such a great swerve. What did you make of that one?
Loved it. Loved it at the time and loved it now even more, like I said, with that retroactive knowledge. So that really sets up, you know, the show going forward. In terms of the plot of this episode, it really is mostly foundational work. The supposed villain of the week is this Adam Hunt character who is fine in his couple roles, but not really much to write home about in terms of that overall plot. It's just kind of establishing
what, the book. Yeah.
The structure of at least like the first half of season one is going to be, which is the list of Oliver's father's names in the book.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed a few interesting names in that book, by the way. Isabel Rochev, who would appear
in season two,
is actually in the book. And mm-hmm. There's a character, who was it, that would later appear on The Flash that was actually in the book. And then I looked this up online because I didn't know it. Later in the season, I think in episode 6, the inside on the list is the name of the guy that they would end up using as Prometheus's father.
Oh.
So yeah, a lot of good stuff there. I want to also throw a shout out to a couple of people that were listed as sort of recurring or guest performers. Colin Salmon as Walter Steele. I really liked Walter. Talk about a character that got the short shrift, by the way. Walter really kind of got screwed on the show because he was a guy that made a lot of good decisions and was a good guy to Oliver and ends up getting kind of written off the show unceremoniously. But he would rebound nicely. He ended up playing General Zod on Krypton and did a good job of that. But I thought he was really good here. Walter was a guy that I also – you talk about Tommy. I always thought Walter would come back to the show in some sort of an important role, but it never really happened. And then you've got Jamie Sheridan as Robert Queen, Nick.
Mm.
Very good. I was forgotten actually that they showed all this in the first episode. I thought the flashback of them being on the boat happened later in the season, but no, it's all here in the pilot where Robert shoots the guy that's kind of with them and then ends up shooting himself right in front of Oliver. And what a shocking moment that is in the episode. If you're watching it the first time, you certainly don't see that coming. I remember that would be one of the things we talked about on the phone after that episode was, damn, I did not expect his dad to shoot himself, especially on a network, you know, CW drama like that. Pretty heavy. One scene that didn't work as well to me in the episode was, I can't remember if it was that particular scene or if it was the scene when Sarah gets sucked into the ocean.
Oh, the Sarah getting sucked into the ocean scene looks so fake.
Yeah, yeah. And then was it that same scene where Oliver wakes up in his room and it's raining in the room and Moira comes in and he's back? It just looked so – it felt like a Batman scene.
Because he was sleeping in the window with the door – with the window open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that sequence didn't work too well for me. But but her getting sucked into the ocean didn't look good. But the everything else – It's a good episode, like from the get go. There's some bad stuff in it that they would fix later. Another thing that stands out about this, and this was kind of why the show got buzz, I think, in the early days, to separate it from the rest of the TV slate. The action is great.
Oh, great! Yep.
I mentioned the parkour. The parkour chase across the roofs of the what is that district called in Star City where they are?
The Glades.
The Glades. The parkour chase in the Glades still holds up to this day as a great, great scene. Oliver's tearing through Adam Hunt's – I almost said Ethan Hunt, the character from Mission Impossible. Tearing through Adam Hunt's crew is great. A lot of usage of the bow and arrow, which I love because they kind of got away from that in later seasons. He doesn't do mm-hmm. quite as much archery, and I thought it was really cool how they incorporated the archery in this one. We got some of the – trademark training sequences that would become one of the staples of Arrow with the salmon ladder and then the tennis balls that he's firing the arrows through, which I had forgotten about and kind of makes me appreciate that little recent training sequence with Oliver and his daughter, Mia. So what kind of stood out to you about the action in this episode? Do you think that was sort of a calling card for them early on?
Absolutely. The emphasis on fight choreography, even from the beginning, like, especially in – what year was this again, 2012?
Yeah.
The tendency at that time in not just television but, like, all of action media was to do what we affectionately refer to as the Bourne style, where everything is shaky mm-hmm. and hard to you know, hard to make out. And this, I appreciated their restraint. They pulled back. They let you actually see the action scenes play out, which was remarkable. And in most cases, the choreography is really damn good, and that would become a hallmark of the show for the majority of its run. So yeah, I definitely appreciated that.
Yeah, and actually right now I'm watching the scene where Oliver escapes the car while Diggle is driving it, which is great. But an interesting factoid about the shooting of this show, it looks pretty smooth from the get-go. It's actually directed by David Nutter, who also directed the pilot of Smallville and several episodes of that show. And so, you know, it has this kind of polished look to it. And the general, like, colorization is very Nolan-inspired. They're trying to be gritty with this. They're trying to be street level. They're trying to be violent with it. And they succeed. They come out and they set their tone. They set their pace for what they're going to be in the season moving forward, that this is going to be a ground-based show. This is going to be a superhero show, yes, but it's going to be a superhero show that's more grounded in a version of the real world, basically. So, right out of the gates, they nail the tone. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that would stay the same on Arrow moving forward and some of the things that would differ. What stood out to you as far as things that from Jump Street they just kept and this was going to be a staple of the show for years to come? And what are some things that they would have to tweak and adjust other than that interior monologue that we mentioned earlier?
Well, the characters, first and foremost, like we were saying, I mean, Oliver, John Diggle, and Quentin Lance are kind of there from the jump. And they are pretty much fully realized. And yes, we would see them go on journeys throughout the years, but I would argue there was never really a massive character overhaul for any of them. Everything felt natural.
Right.
And like it extended from that first episode. In terms of things they would have to add to, you know, I think Thea did change over time necessarily. And you had to develop that. But then obviously the biggest thing is that they realized the show needed a full-time female participant in Oliver's journey. And it wasn't until season 3 of this episode, in a random just one-off at first, that we got episode 3 of season 1, that we got the first appearance of Felicity Smoke, initially as just a one-off guest appearance and quickly expanding into a full-time regular role. And I would argue it isn't really until she becomes a major focus of the show that Arrow becomes what we know it as now.
Yes, I agree. Arrow finds its identity with her because even though this is a very good episode, it's clear that this is basically Batman with a bow and arrow and Christopher Nolan's Batman with a bow and arrow. It isn't until, I think, to your point, Felicity joins that you get that full-time female presence on the show with a very strong character and a very different character, that Arrow finds its own identity, that it adds a little bit of needed quirkiness to the show to make it. It could have been good regardless. It could have been good just as you see here in the pilot, but it could not have been great. It could not have been as unique as it would become without her on there. And I think one of the things that we have to give credit to Berlanti and company for is their ability to adapt and their willingness to adapt. You talked about dropping the inner monologues a few episodes in to season 1. In addition to dropping the inner monologue a few episodes into season 1, I think the original plan for this show, and I'll probably believe this until I'm told otherwise, was that Laurel was going to be the primary female presence. She was going to become the Black Canary, clearly, and she was going to be the love interest for Oliver Queen. What becomes apparent in these first few episodes, it's not as apparent in the pilot, but it becomes more apparent as you watch this season, is that the two leads at this time, Katie Cassidy and Stephen Amell, just don't have any chemistry together in terms of romantic chemistry, in terms of you want to see these characters play off of each other. Now, Tommy Merlin and Laurel Lance actually do have some chemistry. They have an interesting dynamic, but it just never clicks with Oliver and Laurel on this show. A lot of shows, most shows, would just stick by what they originally planned. And they would say, well, damn it, this is how it is in the comics. This is how we're going to do it. This is Black Canary and Green Arrow.
And it's gotta happen. Let's not forget, there are many fans who would insist that you do what it was in the comics, even if the chemistry isn't there for these versions of the characters.
Correct. And I would argue that they made the right decision by pivoting from that. Because when Felicity comes on, she's supposed to be a minor one-off character, really. maybe a recurring character at best, and then they quickly bump her into a recurring role and then eventually a series regular. And to this day, she's considered one of the three leads, really, of most of the seasons of Arrow, along with Amell and Ramsey. And they create the original Team Arrow that I think we all still think of as Team Arrow, with Diggle, Felicity, and Oliver. They are willing to make that adjustment as the season progresses, add that in there. They're willing to get a little bit more comic booky as the season progresses. They introduce some characters and concepts that are maybe would have felt outlandish perhaps when they first pitched the series. But I think as they realized that this was working, that the cast was working, they felt a little bit more comfortable introducing concepts like the Suicide Squad, concepts like Deathstroke, Deadshot, who's actually introduced pretty early, the Huntress, people like that. And you sort of start to find an Oliver Queen that, yes, is a lot like Bruce Wayne, but also has differences and things about his supporting cast that are a little bit different. And the also the kind of creation of the Dark Archer adds a lot here, and the pivoting of, I think, all of us. I don't know if you remember this, but I certainly was convinced that Tommy Merlin was going to be revealed as the Dark Archer
for the longest time. Right, we all were at the time.
And swerve of swerves, it's Malcolm, and then Tommy ends up dying a good guy, which I never expected. And so I think, I don't know if that was completely the plan from the beginning, maybe it was, but it's a testament that this show is able to hone in on the characters that worked and largely jettison the characters that didn't. You know, we don't get a lot of focus on Laurel until later on because her character was not really working that well. They did focus on her a little bit, but Felicity took a lot of the attention away. And we also saw Thea go through her drug arc that she had. But you start to see a focus on these dynamics that were becoming the linchpins of the show. And moving forward, you would have Oliver and Quentin as a key relationship. You'd have Oliver and Diggle, Oliver and Felicity, Oliver and Thea as sort of Oliver and Tommy as sort of the key, you know, these two people really care about each other in some way, whether it's hatred, whether it's love, and they focused on that big time moving forward. They also would double down on the action as the series would go along and really found that right balance, that right mix, rather than being stubborn with, you know, as you alluded to, well, this is how it is in the comics and this is how we have to do it. They were willing to change what they needed to change, tell their own story, as I would argue the best Green Arrow runs do. You won't find all that many similarities in the Mike Grell Green Arrow run and the Denny O'Neil, Neil Adams Green Arrow run, but they're both excellent. They tell their own stories and do a great job of it. And ditto Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino's run on Green Arrow. So I think this show finds its identity, but also is willing to trial and error as well, right? Like attempt some things. They don't always work, but they're willing to tweak things and never rest on their laurels, so to speak, going into, you know, with the exception we talked about season four being a big miss, but they swung for it, you know, it just didn't work.
Right.
So with that being said, what were your overall impressions of this episode going back and rewatching it? You know, we always talk about how Arrow had to find its footing a little bit, but I got to say, I really enjoyed this pilot a lot more than I expected to going back and rewatching it.
Same, exactly the same. I, you know, we talk about that and it's true, but I think in saying that over the years, we've kind of discredited how good it was from the jump. And I think perhaps our enjoyment of it could be related to the fact that the early episodes are very much in a tone that we appreciate, and they are in our preferred tone for the show in general that it has strayed from a few times throughout it. Mm-hmm. So to see it, you know, returning to its roots almost and being, you know, the kind of show that we usually want it to be from the jump, I think causes us to appreciate it even more in hindsight. And to be honest, the characters, the tone, the general setup of it, just makes me want to go back and rewatch the show from the beginning.
Yeah, you texted me that the other night when you were watching it, and I had the same experience. Because, and actually, I did go back and watch the first half of the second episode last night, actually. I haven't finished it yet because I had to go to bed. But it's just the tone. You're right. The tone, the emotional angst of this character. And it really, it comes down to Oliver Queen is such a great character from the get-go. Like, he is tortured and he's angsty and he's angry at the world deep down, but he has to cover it all up. And yes, I know there's a lot of people out there that would, you know, scoff at that. Well, he's a superhero. He shouldn't be angsty and all that bullshit. I love it. Like, that's what I want.
Batman has been angsty for most of his existence and people love that character.
Yeah. And it's, and for me, it's like that makes Oliver's journey worth watching. And part of that, part of the greatness of this show at its best is the journey of Oliver Queen, that he's not a character who is the same from the beginning to the end of the show. He's a character who grows over the course of time and has to overcome what we see in this pilot episode, who was breaking people's necks and shooting arrows through people's hearts, how he grows from that into the man he becomes in later seasons. And as you mentioned, the show is at its worst when it strays from this tone, and it's at its best when it embraces this tone of one man and a few choice allies against a corrupt city, rather than one man and a team against hackers or super-powered wizards or whatever, you know? this is when the show is at its best, and the best seasons are informed by what we see all the way back in this pilot, whether it be season 2, season 3, season 5, even that prison arc in season 7. It's all tied back to the roots that were laid in this episode. So I agree with you, Nick. This is a really good episode right out of the gate, and I kind of want to do a rewatch project, and maybe I'll have some time to do that soon. So it certainly flies by on Netflix, by the way, with no ads. So
yes,
that makes it an easy watch as well. So any final thoughts before we sign off on this one?
No. Just to remind people, or just to throw a little disclaimer out there, once again, no back half of the show this week. It has been a work week from hell for both of us, yeah. And we promise that we will get back into our normal routine next week.
Yes.
And we make that promise to you, but we also reserve the right
to break it.
To break that promise with no regret. So we offer you that worthless promise.
Absolutely. We very well may enter the transfer portal, which could certainly influence things. But no, the
protect your pinkies.
Yes. Yeah, so, but yeah, the their plan right now is for us to come back next week with a long book hunt, looking at the comic book adaptation of Arrow, which is a web comic actually. Mm-hmm. It was collected later on. I've actually been reading it already. It's not bad. It's very different than what we're used to in comics, because they're very short, like really short issues. So. That's going to take some getting used to. We got to figure out how many we're going to read and all that stuff. But yeah, so, and we're going to, the book that we're going to look at is going to be Arrow season 2.5, which takes place, as you would expect, between seasons 2 and 3. Filling in a little bit.
The reason they are so short, by the way, is DC's digital comics at that time were half length, and then they were combined together. Two of them were combined into one print issue.
Ah, okay.
I was buying Batman 66 at the time, which was a digital first comic, and they would take two of those and put them together into one print issue. So you would get them every 2 weeks on through digital, or you could wait once a month for the collected print version.
Wow, that's interesting. That's an interesting approach. Yeah, so we'll come in next week and we'll discuss that and let you know what we thought about it. And in the meantime, we will hope you have a good weekend, and we will tune in same hard traveling time, same hard traveling channel. Catch you next week.
promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, hard traveling fanboys listeners, it's your manager Todd Weber here to tell you about the latest happenings on Place to Be Nation, Pop, the podcast feed, as well as our wrestling feed and our website, PlaceToBeNation.com. Hey, first up, on the Pop feed, we've got weekly shows Monday through Friday. That's right. My dream of a new show every day has been achieved. Every Monday, we've got the Brother Sister Rewatch podcast, currently watching The Office. They just watched episodes 9 and 10 of season 4 of The Office, including the greatest episode of all time, in my opinion, Dinner Party. Just one night, you made everything feel all right. Every Tuesday, we've got Diamond Conversations with Chad B. This week, he talked to Walt Friedman from Summer Games Books. On Wednesdays, we've got It Was a Thing on TV, another new show about TV. Latest show had Mike and Greg talking about Match Game and Hollywood Squares revival, short-lived, early in the 80s, and then they watched a show called Mr. Smith, a very hyped show that did not last. Every Thursday, we've got a couple shows. We've got This Week in the NFL, while the NFL season is still going. We've also got whatever Andy Atherton is purveying. That includes all of his shows, which are The Great Debate, Looking Forward, Looking Back, Laugh in Theater, and The Year in Pop. Fridays are, of course, the home of the hard-traveling fanboys. Your weekly episodic, yeah, them. We've also got lots of other great shows, including Glenn Butler Podcast Hour, Spectacular, and others. Be sure to check out the wrestling feed. Includes a deep dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE through yesteryear. The feed includes PTB Podcast, Main Event, Wrestling Warzone, Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jenny and the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, and much, much more. Subscribe to that feed as well. We have a spin-off feed called The Jenny Position, Jennifer Smith's shows, her family, Geek and Sassy Talking Pop, Freak Out Driving, and Telling Stories, plus much more. Greatest Sitcom of All Time tournament is taking place now on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Check it out. We're in round one. People are getting hurt feelings all the time, but that's the way these tournaments go. We've also got our 2020 stretch project determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have to research and nominate. Of course, the greatest match of all time from WCW is Halloween Havoc 1997, Guerrero Mysterio. But there will be a 99 other ones to read about. Eventually, nominate. Get into it. Refresh PlaceToBeNation.com every day. We've got articles, all our podcast links, all kinds of stuff every single day. Click on our banner at PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon. It's also on our homepage. It takes you right to Amazon. Buy your Depends, undergarments, and whatever you need to, and it helps us out. Continue to check out the archives of our feeds for tons of great content. And thank you for listening to the Hard Traveling Fanboys on Place to Be Nation Pop. Dig, 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 dig
diggity dick diggity dog. Breaking dick dick diggity dick diggity dog. Diggity, dick, diggity, dog. Breaking, dick, diggity, dick.